I'd like to take the title for our thoughts tonight from the text here and put it in question form. What does God require? Before we look at that question and seek to answer that question from the text here, because the text does answer the question, I'd like to look a little bit more at the times in which Micah was living so we can understand better why that question was being asked, and what perhaps was all involved with that question. Prophet Micah, or the name Micah, means who is like Jehovah. He was a prophet. You go back to the beginning of the book, during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. That's in chapter 1, verse 1. So he had a long ministry. It spanned the reigns of three different kings. We don't know what time in the reign of Jotham he would have come to begin his ministry, but if it would have been most of the reign of Jotham, it could have been up close to between 50 and 60 years of ministry. And so he was he would have been known in Israel for a long time. This message, even though it's a short book, seems to have come different portions at different times during the reign of those kings. We know that he speaks both to Samaria and to Judah. So Israel had not yet gone into captivity when he began to give his message. His message is to the capital cities: Samaria, which was the capital of Israel, and then Jerusalem, which was the capital of Judah. And so you might say, if we were to put that in our terms, this is a message for the White House, or this is a message for the nation, or this is a message that our leaders ought to pay close attention to. Now, even though the message is specifically for the capital, or Samaria and Judah, or Israel and Judah, there's a lesson here that's to be taken or noticed by all the world. We notice that in chapter 1, verse 2. Hear, all ye people, hearken, O earth, and all that therein is, and let the Lord God be witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. So what the prophet Micah is saying is this: what God is going to bring to pass in the land of Israel and in the land of Judah is to be a testimony to all the earth in how God addresses sin and how God deals with a nation. All of the earth is to pay attention. A universal application. Now, looking further at the times in which Micah prophesied, moving over to chapter 3, reading verse 1. And I said, hear, I pray you, O heads of Jacob. There again is the idea that he's speaking to the leaders. And ye princes of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know judgment? In other words, shouldn't you in your position have a good understanding of what God is requiring for you to do in this time in which you live? That's the question that he's putting before them. It's given a very obvious implication that they don't know what to do. They're in hard times, and they don't have a good moral compass. They're not able to exercise sound judgment. Moving down to verse 9. Hear this, I pray you, ye heads of the house of Jacob, and princes of the house of Israel, that abhor judgment and pervert all equity. First he asks the question, shouldn't you be the ones who would know what judgment is? Because after all, is that not what you're called to exercise, sound judgment? Now he goes further and addresses them again and says, the reality of it is this: you abhor sound judgment. You pervert equity, or you pervert the right ways. You confuse truth. That's really what you're doing. It's not what you're called to do, but in reality, that's what you are doing. Verse 10. Speaking of the leaders, they build up Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. In other words, your plan for the future is based on perversion. Somehow you think that how you're going to solve the problems of this nation is through multiplication of iniquity. You've walked away from good, sound judgment. And the answers that you think that you have for the nation are based not on truth, but based on iniquity. Verse 11. The heads thereof judge for reward. So it talks about the judges in the land. The judges in the land are more concerned about what the financial outcome of their judgment is than determining what is the truth of the matter. And the priests thereof teach for hire. In other words, the clergy of this country is hireling clergy, is what he's saying. They're more concerned about their salary than they are about truth. They're more concerned about what they teach and how it's going to affect their financial outcome than they are about what the Bible says. And the prophets thereof divine for money. Those who claim to have a word from the Lord are focused on what is the payback going to be. Yet they will lean upon the Lord and say, is not the Lord among us? In other words, even in this false message, even in this message that's delivered for financial gain, they're trying to give the indication that the Lord is speaking. They're actually giving the indication that we should rely upon the Lord. But the reality of it is their message, which says we should rely upon the Lord, is actually a false message, and it's all about how well my book will sell. None evil can come upon us. That's the other part of their message, is here is what you can do to escape the judgment of God. So we have rulers that oppress. We have unjust taxation. We have extortion taking place. Judges that are ruling based on promotion or gain. And spiritual leaders that are servants to salaries. In addition, going back to chapter 1 and verse 7, we see that idolatry is on the rise, and all the graven images thereof shall be beaten to pieces, and all the hires thereof shall be burned with the fire, and all the idols thereof will I lay desolate, for she gathered it of the hire of an harlot, and they shall return to the hire of an harlot. In other words, when judgment's coming, all of this is going to be destroyed. But it shows that what has taken place is they've actually turned from the truth, and they've actually hired and given the ear to other religions. Maybe in other religions we can find the answer. That's literally what it's saying. And so the people said, you know, maybe we should be more open-minded. Maybe we shouldn't just follow the old narrow bigoted way. Maybe there's truth in other religions. And God is saying that when the land is destroyed, that's one of the things he's going to go for. The utter destruction of idolatry. Chapter 1, verse 9. Micah says, her wound is incurable. For it is come unto Judah. He has come unto the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. What he's saying is this. It has gone beyond the point of return. That's early in his message. That they have gone that far that judgment will come. No matter what, judgment will come. And so when the people are saying, when the prophets are saying, none evil can come upon us, What these false prophets are really saying is, don't listen to what Micah's saying. I got a way where we can avoid God's judgment coming upon our nation. I got a plan. We can avert God's judgment. Micah reiterates, destruction is coming. Chapter 3, verse 12. Therefore shall Zion, for your sake, be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountain of the house as high as the places of the forest. What Micah is saying, God is going to send judgment, if for no other reason, to set the record straight between what the prophets have foretold and what the false prophets are trying to appease the ears of the people. Now, that's not all that's coming. Go to chapter 4, beginning at verse 1. But in the last days, now we ought to pay attention, because this prophecy that's spoken of in relation to a present condition of Israel is now moving forward to the last days. That tells us there's going to be a replay of what is taking place here. In the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow into it. And many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. For all people will walk, every one, in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Some of this, I believe, is a clear indication of what's going to take place during the millennial reign of Christ. But I believe there's other things here that tie into principles of the New Testament. On the one hand, Micah is saying, this nation will be judged. But on the other hand, he's saying, the law of the Lord is going to go forth, and many nations are going to hear it. God is going to judge Israel to show the testimony of truth and to reveal the false prophets. But at the same time, the truth is going to go forth into all the earth. Do you see the paradox that's there? What he's telling Israel is, it may be the end of the nation of Israel as we currently know it, but it will not be the end of the truth. In fact, the indication seems to be, this nation will be destroyed, and the truth will go forth. Is that not literally what happened when Israel went into captivity? People that did not know the truth. The Jews took the truth into Babylon, into Persia. Daniel stood before kings and witnessed to the truth. By the time of the New Testament, there were synagogues all over the Asia Minor. We see that what was the lowest point in Israel's history, actually God used to spread truth throughout all the world. Notice also when this takes place. Verse 5 of chapter 4 that I read. For all people will walk, everyone, in the name of his God. In other words, there's going to be a multiple religions of the world. And everyone is going to put their religion out as this is the right way. And there's going to be a lot of confusion. But in the midst of that confusion, there's going to be those who will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. So in the midst of an age of pluralism, there's going to be worldwide evangelism. In chapter 5 is a messianic chapter. It talks about the coming of Christ. And I think the indication here is very clear that when we see these things begin to come to pass, lift up your head, for your redemption draws nigh. And so we ask the question first, can we identify with the times of Micah? You know, sometimes it's good for us to understand before we look at the message of the prophet that we understand the times of the prophet. Their message was given in a time of confusion, a time of apostasy, a time of hopelessness. Our nation is coming to an end. Do you not think that there were many Jews who were still righteous and still wished, God, is there not some way that we can avoid this judgment? What is going to happen to us when it all comes to an end? You can also sense the frustration. You know, as time moved on, Elijah was a later prophet than Micah. He was during the reign of Ahab. Or I should say that their ministries probably overlapped somewhat, because there's mention also of the house of Ahab in verse 16 of chapter 6. And so there was some overlap there. But during the time of Elijah, when Elijah thought that he was the only one, God reminded him that there were many others that were still faithful. And I'm sure it was very difficult for those many others, and frustrating, to see the nation on the railroad to destruction. And so we can look at this and we can say, well, I don't see anything real encouraging in that. But let's look at what the New Testament says. Romans chapter 15, verse 4. For whatsoever things were written aforetime, that's the Old Testament, were written for our learning. Why? Because some of the lessons and history is going to replay again. That we, through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. If we were to look today at what is happening in Washington alone, it will look pretty hopeless, because right now the leaders of our nation are wringing their hands, and all of them are saying there's no easy way out. But we, through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. So the question is this: what am I to do now? How does God want me to live in these times? And I think the answer to that is in the text. With that in mind, let's look at this question in Micah chapter 6, verse 6. Here's the people of Israel coming to Micah after they've heard his prophecies. Israel and Judah are going to be destroyed. Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of ram, or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? What is the question there? The question is simply this, I believe. What's it going to take to stop the judgment from coming? How much do we need to do in order for God to just forgive us? That's what we want. We just want to be forgiven. We want our lives to go on like they always have. We don't want this discomfort. What's it going to take for God just to forgive us and to forget it all? We're willing to make big sacrifices. We're willing to spend a lot of money. That's what they're saying. We're willing to spend a lot of money in order to avoid the inevitable. Can we buy off God by our giving? Can we just be forgiven and move on in life with no further consequences for sin? In reality, the people are saying this: God, I really don't want to hear you, and I really don't want to obey you, but I would like for you to forgive me. I would really like my giving to be recognized as good enough for forgiveness. A religious show of giving or good works can never merit God's forgiveness of grace. Sin is not pardoned with money. Grace cannot be earned. They even offer their children. In other words, they knew, they were taught again and again that they were not to put their children through the fire. And they're that desperate that they're saying, we're willing even to offer our children. Lord, you can take our children, you can have our children. Just don't let us go through this misery that you've predicted. God had already said, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. And in the New Testament, he says, it's not possible that the blood of bulls and of goats should take away sin. And here's a very clear indicator of the insufficiency of the Old Testament sacrifices to ever cancel out sin. Why were they performed? They were performed primarily for two reasons. To remind them that they were sinners again and again and again. And that only the blood could take away sin. So God is not most interested in your possessions or your giving, but in your heart and in your life. Because if he has you, he has all your possessions anyway. We should not bargain with God when he has shown us what he wants. You know, it's human nature to try to live the Christian life by saying, you know, here's a verse in the Bible that I can obey. I can feel comfortable obeying this. So if I focus on obeying this, maybe God will let me go if I disobey some of the other areas that I really am not interested in obeying. And the point is here, you can't buy God off. Carnal professors want forgiveness without giving God their life. They want to make a profession of forgiveness and then live like the heathen. But he has shown us what he wants us to do. They ask the question like, well, God, we're in difficult times. How are we supposed to handle this? God's answer is this: he has shown you. In other words, God is saying this: my answer is never any different any time in any age. It's not about finding what is the right thing to do now. But the answer is continue to do the right thing. He has shown thee, O man, what is good. Another way of saying this is, you want to be a man in these times? This is what you do. Do justly. The word justly literally means this: be discerning. Be willing to pass a verdict. Make a determination. Discern the right from the wrong. God is saying, first of all, be discerning. He that is spiritual judges all things. You know, one of the most known verses in the Bible that's used right now, and Brother Ray brought it to our attention a while ago, is, "Judge not that ye be not judged." How about all the verses that speak of the necessity of exercising righteous judgment? Yes, we're to do justly. We're to evaluate ideas in the light of God's truth. Judge not that ye be not judged. In other words, don't make people your case studies. But you need to make truth your case study. Evaluate everything you hear in the light of truth. He has shown thee, O man, what thou art to do. Do justly. Do our children know how to evaluate what they hear? You know, it's easy in times of moral decline to feel like we're all right because we can always look around us and find people that are more sinful. But when God says do justly, he's saying compare it to my standard of justice. He says do justly, and I believe that primarily it's we are to address the sin in our own lives, that God gives us the power to overcome. That is to be the witness to others. In the times of injustice, which is what Micah lived in, when people were not exercising justice, God is saying, first of all, you personally do justly. You take a just evaluation of yourself. Before you speak in condemnation of others, have you measured your own life in light of my truth? You know, one of the reasons the church is powerless in this time is because they're trying to judge the world and not the sin that's in the church. Judgment must first begin at the house of God. You know, there's a lot of corruption and injustice around us that we cannot change. And we're not responsible for what we cannot do. But we are accountable for what we can do. And what we can do is do justly. We can treat others justly. We can sacrifice our own desires to pay what we justly owe to others. In a time when people are spending what they don't have, we can show that we will be responsible. When we make a commitment to other people, we will sacrifice in order to keep our word. We can help those who are less fortunate. We can show others the way of righteousness. We can discern between right and wrong, and we can lead our families and influence others for the right. That is to do justly. That's what God wants us to do right now. We're also to love mercy. Mercy balances out justice. Discernment and evaluation and a focus on the truth without mercy can at times be a pretty rigid club. And so while we're doing justly, we're to love mercy. We're to love to show mercy. Mercy and judgment must walk together in balance. We must always point ourselves and others away from sin and always towards righteousness. That's exercising judgment. But at the same time, we must also show that we love to forgive other people. We love to show mercy. We love to reconcile with others. When others fall short, we would rather show them mercy than correction. Correction is necessary in order to do justly. But we love also to show mercy. Mercy is reaching out to others with deeds of kindness to help them even when they do not deserve it. That's what mercy is. It's giving to someone that which they do not deserve. And we must love to extend mercy. You know what a good check is for us? When you think that you've done someone a favor, think about this. Does the person that I've just shown mercy to, do they feel any obligation to me in return? Or have I left them under any impression that they owe me something because of the good deed that I've done? You see, mercy is showing kindness to someone even when they don't deserve it and making it clear that nothing is owed in return. That is mercy. And thirdly, walk humbly with thy God. Walking with thy God means walking away from sin. There's no deliberation over it. We're walking, we have a path. That path is with God. We walk with God, that is, we keep in step with His progress and pace. We're not focused on forcing God's plan. You know, anytime apostasy comes into a church or a nation, there's always an opposite and an equal tendency to react, to try to force people and change back to the right. To force it back. But God says, do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with thy God. Humbly means in a way that exalts God, that diminishes attention to ourselves. Do we draw attention to our path or to the footprints of Christ? In this idea of walking humbly, I think we can say that humility should grow with our character and our wisdom. We are to walk with God. That means that His presence is near us. Can others tell that God is near when they are around us? If we walk with God, when others come into our presence, we should remind them that God is here. Our presence, because God is with us, itself is a rebuke to sin. Walk humbly with thy God. Thy means relationship, fellowship. He is real to us. In Micah's time, there was a lot of voices. There was a lot of people saying, God has said, or thus saith the Lord. And there have been a lot of people that would have been confused and saying, well, how do I know what the Lord's really saying? Because there's a lot of people saying different things and they're all claiming it's from the Lord. But God is saying here, walk humbly with thy God. And when people want to know what God is saying, it will go to those whom they know are walking with God. Enoch had this testimony that he walked with God. Hebrews 11:5 said he pleased God. How do we leave a testimony? How do we please God? By humbly walking with God. We do not have any record of any of Enoch's deeds, of any great things that he's done. The only record we have is that he walked with God and he pleased God. What am I to do? Do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with thy God. What is God asking us to do right now? He's already shown us. It's nothing new. We don't need a new revelation. We don't need a new voice to speak. What we need to do is what God has shown us to do. It's the same in every age, every time, every culture, every condition. I believe that we should begin the process in this order. Do justly. God, show me the truth. Should be our first prayer. Then God, help me to love those who are not walking according to the truth, to love mercy. And God, help me to walk with you.